a lot of stories about the Reformation. We tell stories about Martin Luther and the 95 Theses. We tell stories about theological courage and disputes. We tell stories about Protestants and Catholics. Today, I'd like to tell a story that you probably have never heard before from the Reformation. It's a story of how the Protestant reformers published the Quran. But in order to set up that story, let me give you a little bit of background for how we got to the situation of the Protestant Reformation and Islam. So if we think of the world, what scholars will call the late antique world, roughly the 3rd to the 8th centuries, it was a world that was religiously complex. The story starts with the creation of an identity that people start calling Judaism. So you have a nation of Israel previously, but really it's in the 1st century BCE, maybe the 1st century CE, right around the time of the life of Jesus, that you have a congealed identity and people start using this term, Judaism, to refer to this community of people that is living in the Eastern Mediterranean area. And within that complex and diverse world of what we would call Second Temple Judaism, the era of the Second Temple, the temple that is destroyed in 70 CE by the Romans, you start to have a movement emerge that calls itself, it doesn't really have a term to call itself yet, but eventually it calls itself Christianity. But at the beginning, I would call it more Jesusism. So Judaism is actually a diverse, complex tradition that is spread out all around the Mediterranean. There's a large Jewish community that is still in Babylon after the exile. They are the ones who ultimately write the Talmud, or most of it. And you have Judaism spread throughout. There's the Philo, who's a Jewish resident of Alexandria, estimates there are 1 million Jews in the city of Alexandria in Egypt. Right? So it's a huge Jewish population spread throughout. The estimates that we have are that roughly 10% of the Roman Empire was made up of Jews. The population is about 10% of the Roman Empire. And they're spread throughout the Mediterranean. And then you have this movement of Jesusism that begins to emerge as an identity within Judaism that over time begins to separate. So after the destruction of the temple, you have these different interpretations, these different ideas of what Judaism is supposed to be. But at first, this Jesusism movement is really more of a parasitic existence on top of existing Judaism. So if you go back and read the book of Acts, you have Paul going to these different churches, right? He'll go to different communities. He'll go to the synagogue first, interact with his fellow Jews. Paul's a rabbi. And he'll go and interact with his fellow Jews and found a church built upon the foundation of the synagogue, right? Built upon the foundation of the Jewish community, welcoming in Gentiles. But the two communities are very much intertwined in conflict, and they are interpreting Judaism in different ways. So sometimes you'll read your book of Acts, and it'll talk about the conversion of Paul. What did Paul convert from? What did Paul convert to? Paul, that word is not in the New Testament in reference to Paul. He still very much sees himself as a Jew. He sees himself as a rabbi, and he sees himself as somebody who has embraced Jesus as Messiah, but is still holding on to his Judaism. Now, after the destruction of the temple and after this other revolt, this Jewish revolt in the 2nd century called the Bar Kokhba revolts, these two traditions begin to separate in a more clear and coherent way. And so the people that in the New Testament are called the Pharisees, go on to recreate a form of Judaism that we call rabbinic Judaism. Right? And this is the Judaism after the temple. Once the Jewish people have been displaced for a very long time from their homeland, how do they live in this diaspora community? And so they create a form of monotheism that is more textually based, more rooted in the Talmud and the teaching of the rabbis, as well as the Hebrew Bible. And this Jesusism segment then moves off in its own trajectory and becomes what we ultimately call Christianity, or what in Greek might be more directly translated as Christianism, right? But the point that I'm trying to make is within this early, late antique period, if that doesn't sound too strange, within these 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, these two conversations are very much rooted in the same ideas, are very much apart and are connected to each other. Now, over time, partially through the demographic welcome of Gentiles into the Christian community, partially through political co-optation by the Romans, Christianity gets really big and really powerful. And so Christians begin to take over the Roman Empire, and in 312, the Emperor Constantine converts to Christianity. In part, well, he says he converts to Christianity. He still worshipped the sun god until his death, and was baptized on his deathbed. So how sincere his conversion was, we're not totally sure. But at any event, he makes it official that Christianity is okay as one of the religions in the empire, and a few decades later, Emperor Theodosius says that Christianity is the official religion of the empire, and the pagans who had been in the premier seat in terms of late antique religion begin to be persecuted by the Christians. So over time, Christianity becomes the demographic dominant force within this Mediterranean world. And then, in the 7th century, a new voice enters the conversation. And that voice is the Quran. The Quran asserts itself as a restoration of the original teachings of monotheism. And it's in conversation very much with Judaism and Christianity. And the Quran calls Jews and Christians the people of the book. Right? The people of, if you wanted to be a little more literal in the Arabic, the people of the scriptures. Right? And it's recognizing that there are these previous revelations, the gospel through Jesus, the Torah through Moses, and now the Quran comes as the third instantiation of monotheistic religion. And the Quran is very much in conversation as well with the theological disputes that are going on between the Jews and the Christians. So the Quran is aware of the doctrine of the Trinity that Christians are proclaiming, and it comes along and says, don't say three, say one. And there's a passage in the Quran. Jesus is probably the most prominent figure in the Quran. And there's a passage in the Quran where Jesus is speaking and he says to God, I don't know what my followers have been talking about. I never said I was your son. I said I was a prophet. And don't blame me for their misinterpretations. Right? So the Quran is very much aware of everything that has come before it. And it is in conversation with these other traditions. And in the 7th century, it's one of the most remarkable military feats of the ancient and late antique world. The Quran and the Muslim community begins in Mecca and Medina in the Arabian Peninsula. And then over the course of several decades, the Muslim armies conquer most of the Middle East. Right? So the prophet dies in 632. By 638, they have taken Damascus and Jerusalem and then Alexandria. And they ultimately push the late Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, back to Constantinople. They destroy the Persian Empire, and they have pushed all the way across, within a century, all the way across North Africa and up into the Iberian Peninsula, modern-day Spain and Portugal. So within a century after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, you have this remarkable expansion of Islam, which the Muslims interpret as vindication of their version of Abrahamic monotheism. So it's tempting in many ways for us to think of Judaism and Christianity as these Western European religious traditions and Islam as something from the East. Or the point that I want to make is all three of these are Mediterranean religious traditions that arise in this late antique period and congeal in this late antique period. They're all in conversation with each other. They're all siblings in this family of Abraham, arguing and disputing over what is the right interpretation, the right understanding of the one true God. So what did medieval European Christians know about Islam? There are many Christians who are living under Islam. There are many Christians who have been conquered by the Muslim armies. And in fact, many of them welcomed the Muslims because they were tired of the way that the Romans were ruling over them. Many of the Jews welcomed the Muslim invaders as well because they were tired of the way the Christians were ruling over them. But in Europe, where the centers of Christianity shift in the centuries after the rise of Islam, you have various perceptions of Islam. It's kind of the distant threat. Over on the edges of the continent of Europe, you have three different translations of the Quran into Latin. The most popular is by a monk named Robert of Ketton in the 12th century. And so you have the availability of the Quran in Latin, that people are who can read Latin and who can attain a copyright in the 12th century. So everything that is, any book you could possibly get your hands on, somebody had to copy by hand. And so these are spread throughout the libraries of Europe, but who has access to the libraries of Europe? Not very many people. But there are three Quranic translations that are available in Latin. You have these wartime encounters through the Crusades and through other endeavors, and you have some of these voices of these Christian minorities who are living under the Muslim empires who will write and speak about Islam, and that begin to filter into Europe and European perceptions of Islam in this medieval period. And then you have what we would call Christian polemics against Islam, these harsh, exaggerated perceptions of who the Prophet Muhammad is, of who the Muslims are, very much anti-Islam, anti this other religious tradition, this older entry into the conversation. So this is Thomas Berman's summary of the perception from these Christian polemics. Muhammad was a lecherous warmonger, Islam is a bellicose and promiscuous religion, and the Quran is a fraudulent pseudo-scripture compiled from scraps of the Jewish and Christian Bibles, combined with the epileptic ravings of Islam's false prophet. This is the perception in Europe at the time of the Reformation of what Islam is and of who Muslims are and what they believe. And some of these polemics have filtered down to us today. So the perception that is shaped within Europe, within the West, as people begin to refer to themselves against Muslims, has these elements, these very exaggerated critiques of Islam and in many ways misperceptions of what Muslims believe. Now, the other factor that you have to think about in the 16th century, right? So Luther posts his 95 Theses in 1517, again, almost 500 years, or just over 500 years ago. There's been an ongoing battle between the various Muslim empires and the inheritors of the Roman Empire, the Byzantines. And the Byzantines are centered in Constantinople, right on, if I can step over the corner, right here, little peninsula between Europe and Asia. And in the middle of the 15th century, Constantinople is conquered by the Ottoman Turkish Muslim armies in 1453. And this leads to a great expansion of the Ottoman Empire. So the Byzantines are defeated. The Byzantine Empire ends in 1453. And the Ottoman Turks begin to push up into southern Europe, pushing through modern-day Greece and modern-day Hungary up towards the city of Vienna. And about a dozen years after the beginning of the Reformation, as we count it, from 1517, the Ottoman Turks lay siege to the city of Vienna. And so in 1529, and then again in 1532, the Ottoman Turks are sitting at Europe's doorstep. And many people, many scholars and historians who've looked back at this, and even the perception of the time, was that if the Turks could take Vienna, that was the doorway into Central Europe. And if they could take Vienna, they would be basically able to conquer the rest of Central Europe. That was the last stronghold that would keep them out. And so for many people living during the Reformation, both Protestant and Catholic, the perception was that they might live their lives conquered and subjugated under Muslim rule. This was very much a part of the awareness of the time and the ways that they were thinking about their own religious and cultural identities. Now, the other factor in the 16th century that we have to keep in mind in thinking about the Quran is that in the 15th century, you had Gutenberg invents the printing press right around 1440. And this revolutionizes the world of reading and publication. No longer does somebody have to sit down and copy a text by hand. Suddenly, you have the possibility of texts being available in mass printing, or as mass printing as you can get. So this it fuels a movement that we remember as the Renaissance. At the time, they would just call themselves the humanists. And the Renaissance humanists have this slogan in Latin, ad fontes, back to the sources. And the idea of the Renaissance was, we want to get back to the classical era, the Greek and the Roman era. We want to get back to classical culture, bypassing those dirty, ugly, dark ages, those middle ages that were so uninteresting and dull, but they were actually really interesting and fun. But anyway, we want to get back before that And we're going to take those Greek and Latin texts and render them into accessible languages that we have now. Right? So Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and all of these different Protestant Reform figures are also identify themselves as Renaissance humanists. Right? They are also participating in this movement of classical culture. And many of their Catholic opponents also identify themselves as Renaissance humanists. So there's a flourishing of the written and the read word in the late 15th and early 16th century. I have the note over there on my computer, but I believe that the numbers are by the year 1500, so about 60 years after the publication, or after the creation of the printing press, about 20 million volumes have been printed in Europe. Think about that, from small medieval libraries, hand-copied to 20 million volumes. By the end of the 16th century, 100 years after Luther's time, 150 million volumes had been printed. Yes. I think there was a new technology for paper as well. But yes, so that, right, so that suddenly you have this growth of people who can read, and people who are merchants who might otherwise not have any interest in reading, they want to read. They want to be able to read things. They want to be able to interact with texts. And so the Protestant Reformation itself benefits and piggybacks itself off of this movement of learning, this movement of publishing that happens through the creation of the printing press. And so Martin Luther will write a little tract or a little treatise, and within months it's spread all over Europe. Everyone is reading Luther. And similarly with Calvin and his institutes, they are using this new technology of the printing press to spread their teachings, to spread their ideas throughout the world. And the Catholics, if you go back and read the Catholic sources from the 16th century, are very troubled by this, because there isn't this centralized control, there isn't this centralized regulation of what the Protestant reformers are doing, and they're very popular. They're very good writers. Luther is remarkably funny and interesting. I was looking up some quotes from Luther, and I was reading my wife, and he was. It was a polemic against some of the Anabaptists that I was reading last night, against Zwingli, and he said, "Oh yes, the devil certainly has dirty pants on this one." Right? It's vulgar. It's catchy. You are drawn to Luther. Luther is very fun to read. Not a very nice person, but he's very fun to read. And so this spreads throughout Europe. The Reformation is disseminating its information, and by the time the Jesuit order is founded in the Catholic Church, very much in reaction to the Protestants, that you read some of the early Jesuit writings, and they're like, well, we totally disagree with what the Protestants are doing, but we need to copy their strategies, because they're publishing things and they're getting the word out. We need to imitate their strategies, even if we are refuting their doctrine, right? So the Reformation is fueled by, on both sides, by this new technology. So, what about the Quran? It is one of the most important texts. The Turkish Muslims are sitting on Europe's doorstep throughout this period after the creation of the printing press. The Quran itself is a fascinating book, and one that many people want to read, and it's one of the most important books in the world at the time and today, and has already been translated into Latin. So somebody could just take this text and publish it. Somebody could just take this text that everyone is clamoring to read and interact with and publish it. And the fascinating thing is that by a century after the creation of the printing press, nobody had published the Quran. It was seen as a book of heresy. It was seen as a book that would mislead people and cause them to fall astray, to wander from Christianity, or at the very least, to be deceived. And no one was willing to publish it until the Protestant reformers. So let me talk a little bit about how the Protestant reformers thought about Islam and how they perceived the Quran. Martin Luther is probably the most famous figure from the Protestant Reformation, but he is not the protagonist of this story. But at any rate, he is fascinated by Islam. He's fascinated by the Quran. He makes over 5,000 references to the Turks, which is how the Europeans at the time would refer to all Muslims. He makes over 5,000 references in his collected writings to the Turks. Luther writes some different sermons. One of them is called On War Against the Turk, very much endorsing this idea that Europeans should go and fight in this siege of Vienna in order to defend Christian and European culture. he sees this as a defensive war and he justifies it. He has sermons to some of the congregations in Wittenberg saying, here's how you should behave if you are conquered by the Turks. Here's the way that you should live as Christians if you are conquered by these Muslim armies. So he's very interested. And Luther makes comments throughout his early career about how much he wants to read the Quran. He can't get a hold of one of these Latin copies of the Quran. And he laments that. And he says, I've read some of these polemics. He can get a hold of a few of the copies of these polemics, these very harsh and exaggerated perceptions of Islam. And he says, I've read the polemics and I don't believe them. It can't possibly be that bad. I want to read the Quran myself, but he can't get a copy of it. And he talks about this. He doesn't trust these medieval polemics. He says, I want to get a copy of the Quran to read for myself. He's also very concerned about the siege of Vienna, and one of the early Catholic critiques of Luther in the follow up to the 95 Theses, he writes a treatise and he says, because the Catholic Church is so bad, because the Catholic Church is such a destructive force, perhaps we all deserve to be conquered by the Turks. And the Catholic Church seizes upon this and says, see, Luther's a collaborator with the Turks. And he spends the rest of his life refuting that and saying, no, we should fight them. I was just being rhetorical, right? But he because he's such a polemical figure, he uses the Turks in this way. Here's one quote, a good sample of Luther's perception of Islam. The Pope is not much more godly than Muhammad and resembles him extraordinarily. For he, too, praises the gospel and holy scripture with his lips, even though he does not rule with the gospel or word of God, but has made a new law and a Quran, namely his decretals. This is fairly typical of the rhetoric of the Reformation, where you have the Protestants using the distant religious other, the Muslims, to critique the proximate religious other, the Catholics. And the Catholics actually do the same thing. And at different points, you'll read in some of these Catholic sources about how Luther is the equivalent of Muhammad because he thinks he can bring a new revelation, right? So they're very much going back and forth, using rhetorically the Turks as the proxy for the religious disputes that they're having in Europe. Luther at some points calls Muhammad the Antichrist. In some points, he calls the Pope the Antichrist, and it's not totally clear how he reconciled, whether he thought they both were, or whether he was just giving a little flourish in his language as he is wont to do. So Luther, though, is not the protagonist of our story this morning. John Calvin is another great hero of the Reformation. He lives in the generation after Martin Luther. They correspond, although I don't think they ever met in person. But Calvin is not the protagonist of our story either. Calvin is more geographically and chronologically removed from this siege of Vienna. Because he's in the generation after Luther, he's not really experiencing that firsthand, and he's never really lives under the threat of Turkish rule. And so he doesn't show as much concern about this possibility. He has very little interest in the Quran. He has very, very little knowledge of Islam. There's debates over whether he ever saw a Muslim. At one point, there was a Turkish delegation that came to France where he was living at the time, and he might have possibly seen them. But even there, he doesn't give very accurate recollections of what Muslims look like. So it's not totally clear. He has almost no information about Islam, shows no curiosity, really, in his life. He makes 25 references to Muhammad, and most of them, nearly all of them, are comparing Muhammad to the Pope. So again, this trope of comparing the Catholics to these distant Muslims, making the Catholics seem worse through the comparison. This is a little quote from Calvin. He says, the Jews blaspheme, on the one hand, our Lord Jesus, and the Turks deride him and hold him for a phantom, and the papists rob him of most of his graces. So again, using both the Jews and the Muslims as the distant religious other, the people that you have no proximity or closeness to theologically, in order to challenge the Catholics, in order to challenge the Catholic teachings. By the way, I'm not sure what he's getting at exactly with this, the Muslims hold him for a phantom. That's not what Muslims think about Jesus at all. They think that he was a human prophet and that he was maybe the greatest of the prophets. It might be a reference to the Muslim perception that Jesus did not die on the cross, but was taken away by God and somebody else was crucified in his place. That might be what Cowan's getting at, or he might just have zero factual information and is just throwing out a critique of Islam that he knows his audience won't know the difference either. So Calvin is definitely not the protagonist of our story. The protagonist of our story is a backbencher of the Reformation, a man named Theodore Bibliander. If you translate Bibliander from Latin, it's literally bookman. And he was quite the bookman himself. So Bibliander is a disciple of Zwingli. Zwingli is from Calvin's generation. He is one of the early leaders of the Reformed movement, although he had his own views on things that separate from Calvin in many places. And both Zwingli and Bibliander believe in unlimited atonement. If you go back to your catechesis, your training in theology as when you were young Presbyterians, was anyone here a young Presbyterian? Okay. If you remember TULIP, the outline of Reformed theology, the total depravity of humanity, the unconditional election of God, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance or preservation of the saints. I prefer preservation, whatever. So you have this idea that becomes mainstream in the Reformed tradition of limited atonement, that Jesus on the cross died only for those who would believe. In other words, there's no wasted grace on God's part. Jesus would only die for those who would ultimately accept his death. And this becomes part of the Reformed identity and the Reformed tradition. Well, Bibliander and Zwingli believe that Jesus died for everyone. When Paul says he died for all, Paul really means he died for all. And so in their mind, even the Jews and the Muslims are beneficiaries, maybe not salvific, maybe they don't get saved, but they're beneficiaries of the death of Christ. And this is a little bit of an open door to the possibility of maybe more interaction, more learning from Jews and Muslims. Bibliander hoped that he could travel to Egypt as a missionary, and he did a lot of the language learning in order to do so. He was ultimately talked out of it by one of his fellow reformers who made the case that there's so much work to do in Europe still during the Reformation that they don't need to be doing these missionary travels. And so he ultimately didn't do it, but it was a long hope of his. He, over the course of his life, demonstrated knowledge of more than 30 languages, including a rudimentary knowledge of Arabic, because he got there through Hebrew and Aramaic. They're all Semitic languages. They're related languages, so it would be similar to knowing Spanish and learning Portuguese, right? So he's able to gain a working knowledge of Arabic. And so Bibliander is also fascinated by Muslims, fascinated by Islam, is maybe even open to perceiving them positively on some level, and he wants to find some way to get the Quran into the hands of his fellow reformers and the hands of his fellow Europeans. And so he sets out to find a way to publish the Latin Quran. He takes a copy of Robert of Ketton's 12th century manuscript of the Latin translation of the Quran. He finds as well an Arabic copy of the Quran. He buys it from a merchant. And so he's able to compare the two of them. And he edits Robert of Ketton's translation. He adds in biblical referencing system, a cross-referencing system, so you could take the Quran and look up what the corresponding Bible passage is. And he finds a publisher named Operinus in the city of Basel and says, "Will you publish the Quran for me?" And Operinus agrees. Now again, this is an extremely controversial move in the 16th century. It's virtually publishing heresy. And so the city council of Basel says, "We don't want our name on this heretical document," and they arrest Operinus, throw him in prison, shut down his press, and say it's not going to happen. So Bibliander goes and assembles what one scholar has called a host of humanists and theologians, including many of the Protestant reformers, to advocate for this project. And so they begin a letter-writing campaign to the city council of Basel to get the Quran published at Basel. And ultimately, Luther and these other reformers write so many letters. Luther writes and says, "If you don't publish it there, I'm going to publish it in Wittenberg." right, threatening the city council at Basel. And ultimately, the council relents and allows, they release Operinus and allow this publishing effort to proceed, in part because you have names like Martin Luther and his disciple Philip Melanchthon who are endorsing the project, and so they feel like it gives them enough cover. And they tell Operinus, just make sure the name Basel isn't anywhere on the book. So they allow the publishing to go forward. And the end product is this text that they call Al-Quran, the lives of Muhammad, the chief of the Saracen, and of his successors, their teachings, and the Quran itself. It is prefaced by, there's a text by Luther and a text by his disciple Melanchthon that act as these prefaces. They're extremely hostile in the way that they describe the Quran. Luther tells the story of how long he had wanted to read the Quran as a young man and couldn't get a copy of it. And he says, I couldn't believe that it would be as bad as the medieval polemics said, and then I read it and it was worse, right? So he has this very, very negative perception of Islam. And this corresponds in some ways to Luther's very, very negative and really, I would say, despicable perception of Jews at the end of his life as well. One of the great black eyes of the Reformation is the way that Luther and some of his fellow reformers, but especially Luther, wrote and thought about Jews. This includes a cross-referencing system with the Bible that Bibliander had developed so that there could be this comprehensive comparison. This was something new that had never existed before, very much a part of this Renaissance humanism idea of making knowledge and the accessibility and cross-referencing of texts an important part of learning. One scholar who's looked at it calls it a virtual encyclopedia of Islam for 16th century Europe. Everything that Europeans knew about Muslims, everything that they had available to them about Islam, is basically included in this volume. And it's in wide circulation for several hundred years in Europe. It really shapes the early modern perception of Islam throughout Europe. It kind of becomes the text, the source about Islam up until really the rise of Orientalism, the rise of Western scholars who are dedicated to the study of Islam and the East. This becomes kind of this foundational piece of European and Western knowledge about Islam. The Bibliander himself writes a preface to the text. He actually calls it an apologia, a defense of the publishing. And he says, the teachings of the Quran are so disconnected from the divine source, they are absolutely contrary to sanity. And I think it is not permissible to put them into the ears and minds of honest people, except in cases of great necessity. This is the introduction to this volume that he's spent years working on, saying that this is so disconnected from the divine source that it'll drive you insane. You should only read it in moments of great necessity. And yet, the volume exists, and he's the publisher. So he very much sees this as a case of great necessity, putting the Quran into the hands of his fellow Europeans, his fellow humanists. What are some lessons for us from this little story? What's the moral of the story? I have three morals that I'd like to suggest, and perhaps we can come up with some more as we have some Q&A. So the first lesson is that interreligious understanding is very difficult. Even among sibling traditions, even among traditions that have grown up very much in conversation with each other. We now, in our time, have 14 centuries of these polemics and these caricatures and the animosity that has bubbled over between Christianity and Islam through all these centuries. And I meet a lot of people who I find out that I study Islam, and they repeat a lot of these perceptions that come out of this medieval period. The identity of Muslims that gets shaped in the West is very much connected back to these polemics. And as much as the Protestant reformers who did this were doing something I would say that was intellectually brave, I also think it had some great, great deficiencies. The Renaissance and Reformation actually, I would say, represented an information age not unlike our own. where you had this flourishing of knowledge, this availability of knowledge that we have through the internet and other media that allows suddenly for much greater perception, for much, we have so much more data that's available to us. And yet, data without empathy is a very dangerous thing. I meet people all the time who know just enough about Islam to be dangerous. Know just enough about Islam to have a tweaked and a corrupted perception of the Muslim tradition. And think about it this way. If you put together in a room all the worst exhibits of Christianity in America, that take the worst 0.5% of Christians in America and put them in a room, I'd nominate our president for the room. Right? But if you put them in the room and said, that's Christianity, you and I would be incredibly offended. You and I would say, no, that's not the Christianity that I practice. And yet that is what we in the West often do with Islam. We take the caricatures that we see in the media and we read them as representative of the Islamic tradition. There are 1.7 billion Muslims in the world today. If you want to, you can find something in that all that data of 1.7 billion people. You can find something in Islamic history that aligns with this narrative. Right? The data is flexible. In the same way that it is about Christianity. You can define Christianity as being about Constantine and the Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition and the wars of the Reformation and create a fairly negative perception of Christianity. So we have all of this data. We have available to us all kinds of information about Islam. But if that information is not mixed with empathy, we are not trying to understand how Muslims understand themselves, then we are vulnerable to the same sorts of caricatures that were perpetuated through the Reformation. My last moral is that sometimes a small step forward in interreligious understanding comes when we read and interact with the scriptures of another community and try to understand those scriptures the way that they understand them. When I teach introductory theology classes at Georgetown, I always try to get my students to read the Quran because I want them to see what Muslims see in it, understand why this text would form a community of 1.7 billion people and hold them together, give them a sense of identity and purpose and meaning. But if we just come to the Quran as, I'm a Christian and I'm here to refute this, I think we miss even some of the message of the Quran for us because it speaks to us too as Christians. It speaks to us as people of the book. I think that Europe was better off having this volume, having more knowledge available to it about Islam. But I think that it also perpetuated a lot of the problems that came before it and helped perpetuate a lot of the problems that are still with us today in the interactions between these different religious traditions. And I would encourage you to think through how you might interact with Islam, how you might interact and perceive Islam the way that Muslims perceive it. I'm happy to take questions you might have. Yeah. Not especially not in theological circles, no. I mean, you'd have explorers and merchants who were going along the Silk Road and interacting with Muslims. You would have explorers, especially, I mean, the Reformation is the age of exploration, right? And it precedes the age of colonialism, where you have a lot more interactions between Westerners and Muslims, but the power dynamics there are fraught as well. So I'll talk next week about some of the ways that the chaos that ensues after the Reformation plays into some of this. But in the aftermath of the Reformation, you have these religious wars that electrify the European continent, if you wanted to put it as positively as possible. And those wars are not purely Protestant and Catholic. They are Protestants versus Protestants. They are one alliance of Protestants and Catholics against another alliance of Protestants and Catholics. And at one point, the French make an alliance, the Catholic Empire, the Catholic Kingdom of France makes an alliance with the Turks against some of the Protestants. So it's really more chaotic than we have typically remembered it. And so there were kind of official diplomatic interactions like that. But religious identity was so central for people in the 16th century that there wasn't this sense of, oh, we have a lot in common with those people over there. They might be political allies in an extreme situation, but there's not a sense of dialogue. The same thing happens with the Jewish community in Europe, right? The Jews are polemically perceived as the killers of Christ, and these are some of the, again, perceptions that Luther perpetuates and even makes worse in his own writings. And so there's this sense that to have a religious identity other than Christian, much less my sect of Christianity, it's a total barrier for understanding. So this is the work that the reformers are doing here is a work of knowledge, but not necessarily of understanding. Well, so what after the fall of Constantinople, there's all these Greek texts that are in Constantinople that begin to flood into northern and western Europe because the city has fallen and a lot of scholars are taking that knowledge and learning with them. But they're trying to access the Middle East before the rise of Islam. They're trying to access the classical world, both the Christian and pagan classical worlds. That's what they think of as the classical era. And so they're not necessarily interested in the Middle East as an Islamic world. So they very much portray the Turks and the Muslims as kind of persona non grata. They aren't really interested in that learning, apart from kind of this more knowledge interaction with the Quran. Yeah. So I'm sure that there were Muslim merchants and things like that who were, I mean, right, Bibliander manages to acquire a Latin copy of the Quran, but it's not dialogue partners. If anything, they're that's going on in the economic sphere and not the religious sphere. Other questions? Yeah. There aren't a lot of instances until colonialism of Muslims living under Christian rule. There's the Crusades. It's a very brief period where the Christians come and take Jerusalem in the beginning of the 12th century for about 70 years. And the interesting thing about the Crusades is that the Christians, right, so Pope Urban II calls for the First Crusade, and he very much frames it as this is a war between Christendom and Islamdom, right? This is a war against those heretics who've taken the holy city, Jerusalem, and we need to take the holy city back. It really was more of a dispute about access to the holy sites that was driving the whole thing. But in his rhetoric, it was, this is Christianity versus Islam. And so the European Christians gathered around this identity of we're all Christians and we're going to fight for the holy places, and they wind up killing a bunch of Jews along the way, and they get to Jerusalem and slaughter everyone and take over the city, and then 70 years later the Muslims take it back. But within the Middle East, within the Arabic speaking world, the perception is some crazy Franks came in and took Jerusalem for a few decades. This is not the perception of, oh, this is Christianity versus Islam. They don't even frame it in those terms. They don't have a term for the Crusaders. They just call them the Farange, the Franks. And so it's not perceived as Christian rule per se. It's perceived as just a bunch of crazy Europeans came in and took over for a little bit. And it's only in the period of colonialism. It's only in the period of colonial expansion. And about 90% of the Muslim world is under European colonial rule in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries. And so it's only in that period as Muslims realize what a pivotal event the Crusades were for Europe and European identity that the word for crusader, Salabiyya, is coined. So prior to that experience of actually being ruled over by Christians who are using that Christian identity framing in a way that Muslims understand, up until that point, the Muslim world doesn't really see that divide because there are all kinds of Christians in the Muslim world. They're not necessarily they're not necessarily Christians who follow the exact same creeds that we follow. Part of the thing that happens in this diverse late antique world that I showed is there's all kinds of different forms of Christianity, and some of those forms of Christianity are break off from these different creedal councils. And so the Coptic Orthodox Church, the Syrian Orthodox Church, the Nestorian Church, these are all churches that are what we would see as not participating in the ecumenical creeds of the Western Catholic Protestant tradition, but they are still very much identified as Christians. They just have these minor disagreements on theology, and so Christians have denounced them as heretics. And so those are some of the people who welcome Muslim rule when the Muslims get there. Because the Monophysites, who think that Jesus only has one nature, are being persecuted by the Byzantines, who follow more of our formulation of the character and nature of Christ. And so when the Muslims come in, they're like, we don't care about Monophysite versus Chalcedonian Christianity. We'll just let you be Christians, right? And the Monophysites are like, well, that's a lot better than those crazy Romans, right? So it's not, there isn't this feeling of necessarily direct tension. And the Quran gives, because it's inclusive of Jews and Christians to a certain limited extent, it gives Muslims a framework through which to manage those relationships that Christians don't really have. They don't have a way theologically of managing the role of Islam. They have that for Judaism, right? Because Christianity, at least in their perception, has superseded Judaism, but there's a role for Judaism because it gives you the Hebrew Bible, where there's an asymmetry to the rise of Islam. How do we cope with a new monotheism that is trying to supersede us, right? There's a feeling of how do we handle that? And so the Quran gives Muslim rulers more tools for how to think about these other monotheisms. So yeah, there isn't a clear symmetry between Muslims under Christian rule and Christians under Muslim rule. The Jews don't fare very well in either case, although they're probably a little better off under the Muslims for the most part. There aren't really these pogroms that pop up every 100 years or so, although they aren't exactly treated as kings in the Muslim world in the medieval period either. Other questions? So book burning occurs periodically. This is something that the Renaissance humanists are very much opposed to, right? Because in their mind, that's knowledge, right? You're burning knowledge. It happens especially once you have the Catholic response to the Reformation. You start to have the Catholic Church trying to clamp down on what it sees as heretical texts. So the Council of Trent, which is happening around the same time as the Quran is being published, puts together a list of, I think it's over 100 books that are banned books. And those are the ones that would get burned or would get destroyed. But you don't have a lot of that happening on the Protestant side, to my knowledge. I don't think there's a ton of book burning going on. But even the fact that there could be, you could have a book burning is a sign of how many more books there are, right? That there actually are books to burn, right? Like nobody was breaking into these medieval libraries to burn books because A, a lot of people didn't even know they existed and couldn't read them, and B, they were so precious that it would have been seen as a great violation, where the proliferation of texts leads to the possibility of these popular uprisings or dogmatic uprisings against some of those texts. Any other questions? Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.